Welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. We're an international learned society for marine technology, engineering, science, education and policy. My name's Steve Hall, I'm the SUT CEO, and each week we're bringing you an interview with one of our members or supporters working in that broad family of underwater technology-related industries, universities, research organisations, policy developers and more. Podcast 5. Today, I'm speaking to Tony Globe, who's had a long career in the offshore energy sector as a tribologist, an expert in friction, lubrication, and wear, all essential areas in subsea energy production.
Thank you, Steve. So I'm Tony Globe, and I've been involved in the subsea industry for 40 years. I'm a mechanical engineer and tribologist studying under Emeritus Professor of Tribology Jack Schofield at what was then Liverpool Polytechnic Department of Marine and Mechanical Engineering and is now John Moores University. Tribology is a study of interactive surfaces in relative motion, and the course at that time incorporated mechanics of materials, mechanical science, manufacturing technology, bearing technology, and machine design and lubrication. My final year project was modelling the performance of magnetic bearings and couplings, which probably sounds a little strange for someone who spent 40 years after that developing lubricants. For studies, I undertook a number of outplacements, including a six-month period at the Science Research Council's Daresbury Nuclear Structure Facility Materials Testing Laboratory, and I was working on prototypes what eventually became CERN's Large Hadron Collider. Another secondment at Cooper Heat, specialist in welding equipment and pre- and post-weld heat treatment of pipelines. And my last outplacement was at Marston Bentley, now McDermid Offshore Solutions, a lubricants manufacturer producing industrial lubricants, including products for use in extreme and hazardous environments. When I graduated in 1978, I was offered a permanent position at Marston Bentley as technical services manager, and was accountable for the engineering aspects of new products development for use in coal mining, foundries and offshore oil and gas. I was instrumental in converting the global fleet of drill ships and semi-submersibles to aqueous, fire and explosion-resistant hydraulic fluids following a serious explosion within the riser tension system on the semi-submersible Christchenery while operating in the North Sea. I also introduced ranges of water-based subsea control fluids for both production and BOP systems that became the de facto industry standards of their day. In 1992, I joined Castrol as technical manager at their embryonic offshore lubricants division, originally based at Burma Castrol's global headquarters in Swindon. Since then, I've held a number of roles at Castrol, which became part of BP in 2000, including managing a global subsea business, incorporating sales, marketing and technology functions. In 2009, the team was relocated to our International Technology Centre at Pangbourne, and since then I've been a member of the leadership for the BP Aviation and Energy Lubricants business, and more recently, the Global Technical Authority for BP's Marine and Energy Lubricants business. To keep up with the challenges of the developing subsea market through my career, I've also had to acquire a working knowledge of chemistry, microbiology, ecology, and believe it or not, quantum mechanics.
Why quantum mechanics, Tony?
Quantum mechanics, I got involved in a root cause analysis of some failure mechanisms, which involved hydrogen embrittlement. And the question was, how does hydrogen actually get into these locations because they're so small? And the answer is apparently quantum tunneling, which is one of these things where the particle isn't where it isn't anywhere, or it's everywhere until it's where it needs to be. And then that's where it is.
Amazing stuff. And of course, you traveled a lot, didn't you?
My roles have taken me all over the world and to most types of offshore installation, including the first semi-submersible to be built in China. It was in 1983, so welcome to the world of bamboo scaffolding and basket weave hard hats. And to other interesting locations, such as deep coal mines, so that really is working at the coal face, steel foundries, an afternoon technical presentation in Moscow at which the entire audience had spent lunchtime consuming excessive quantities of Stolichnaya vodka, and on one occasion, a locked police cell in East Germany a long time before the Berlin Wall came down in 1991. Don't ask, certainly now, it could be the subject of a whole other podcast.
Brilliant. That's an excellent introduction, Tony. And until today, I hadn't really even come across that word tribology, and I'm just looking at the dictionary definition. So it's saying the study of friction, wear, lubrication, the design of bearings, the science of interacting surfaces in relative motion. So it's something that affects all of us, you know, both in our day-to-day lives, but particularly in subsea production and control systems, which aren't anything like as straightforward a concept as one might think. So, how would you go through explaining how we develop these products for an ever-evolving and increasingly complex subsea industry?
It's a good, challenging question because on the basic subsea production control system concept is fairly straightforward. Hydraulic power is used to drive actuators, which operate valves, which control the flow of hydrocarbons from a reservoir. And the system's got a number of assemblies, hydraulic power unit to provide the driving pressure, pipework to transport the hydraulic fluid to the hardware, and directional control valves to feed hydraulic fluid to the appropriate actuator when required. It seems pretty straightforward, yet one of the most challenging aspects of making sure this equipment operates reliably is the design of the hydraulic fluid that's going to be used in that system. Now, that might sound a bit strange when you look at the tens of millions of dollars that goes into each production control system. After all, control fluid doesn't cost much when you compare it to a subsea tree. So why do I think it's so challenging? And I've thought about this a lot over the last 40 years in the industry, which is not surprising because most of the time that's what I was paid to do. And I think you can break it down into a number of different areas. First of all, the sheer complexity and diversity of the discrete components that make up the system. There are a huge number of components incorporating many different materials, metals, elastomers and plastics, coatings, composites, etc. And the hydraulic fluid has to be compatible with all of these. And for aqueous fluids, which are the most commonly used fluid type, the galvanic effects of combinations of metals can be critical. The operating regime is demanding. Availability has got to be high, but maintainability is low. Equipment's often idle for long periods of time, but must operate first time on demand. And equipment in different parts of the system can be subject to extremely low temperatures on a surface installation, but extremely high temperatures in subsurface equipment, such as subsurface safety valves or intelligent completions. And the hydraulic fluid can and will be exposed to both of these extremes as it passes through the system. In most conventional hydraulic systems, it's relatively simple to avoid contamination or eliminate it by changing fluid. Whereas in a subsea production control system, contamination is to a large degree inevitable. Seawater, completion fluids, reservoir fluids, both liquid and gas, and injection chemicals are all potential contaminants. But the hydraulic fluid is expected to remain both stable and to protect the system when contamination occurs. The continuous pushing of the envelopes of pressure, temperature, water depth, and offsets has led to new hardware designs and introduced new materials that must be accommodated, but also subject the hydraulic fluid to more extreme temperatures that approach what is achievable with the hydraulic fluid chemistry platforms that are currently in use. And they also require the fluids to provide additional protection against phenomena such as subsurface safety valve control line blockage due to gas hydrate formation. Now, over the last 30 years, probably the biggest single factor in driving new hydraulic control fluid development has been environmental legislation. In the early days, water-based fluids were good because they dissolve in seawater, and hydrocarbon fluids were bad because they didn't. Then we got around to evaluating fluids based on marine toxicity and biodegradability, which determined the amount of fluid you would permit to discharge into the sea per annum per installation. The next stage moved us on to testing of each individual component of a fluid, because someone worked out that if you had a product which was mainly made of something readily biodegradable, but the rest was not biodegradable, you're still allowed to discharge a lot of it. Then bioaccumulation testing was added to the list. This is a measure of chemicals' tendency to be absorbed into the fatty tissue of marine species and thus bioaccumulate up through the food chain. Then the chemistry industry managed to produce new compounds that had similar performance characteristics but were biodegradable and therefore permitted, until it was discovered that it biodegraded back to the not-so-biodegradable chemical they'd started with. So now you have to demonstrate that the products of biodegradation are not themselves harmful or persistent. And finally, that as in finally during my career, because I'm sure there'll be more legislation soon. The offshore environmental legislation has been harmonised with health and safety legislation, such that chemicals labelled as hazardous for human contact and requiring personal protective equipment, PPE, are considered not permissible for offshore discharge, even though they meet all of the environmental legislative requirements.
Okay, so in terms of developing a new hydraulic control fluid then, all of these factors have to be taken into consideration, don't they? So that's both individually and collectively. So it's vital to establish the target performance envelope right at the start.
That's exactly right. And I think it's something that requires, first of all, a clear understanding of the equipment and the operating conditions that are anticipated in systems that may not be installed for some years. And as upset conditions such as contamination of the control fluid with other materials is inevitable, what level of robustness can be built in? So this needs a strong relationship with equipment manufacturers and with operators and legislators, and a significant level of understanding of system integration and installation procedures. I think that also one of the factors I've encountered many times is you have to have an appreciation of the timescales required to develop candidate control fluids that can deliver a marked improvement in performance under those conditions. In many instances, the requirements may be exclusive. A fluid of very high thermal stability may also be very resistant to biodegradation. A very effective and reactive chemical that perhaps provides good anti-wear performance may also be very resistant to biodegradation. Effective and reactive chemical may also be toxic to marine organisms. So formulations designed to operate in very low temperatures or to inhibit gas hydrate formulation may be more viscous and increase pressure drop or increase system response times. And finally, increasing temperature has an exponential impact on chemical reaction rates. So corrosion rates increase and product life is actually reduced according to the Arrhenius rate equation.
Okay.
I think the other important aspect here is that because of the timescales and the knowledge that legislation will change, you have to have a clear control fluid retrofit protocol. If a new fluid is being developed specifically or partly to satisfy new environmental legislation for marine discharge, it is probable that legislation will have dictated that existing chemicals that don't meet the new legislative requirements will have to be substituted. There is not really anything that would be considered a trivial change. So generally, any change in formulation is considered to be a new product. There are a few exceptions. There are some exceptions where a minor constituent chemical is used at a reduced level or removed. And then as well as the primary performance requirements, we need to know whether the new fluid is compatible with legacy hardware and with the old fluid, and how items such as soft seals will be effective if already impregnated with the old fluid, and if the system can be retrofitted with a new fluid or the system has to be purged before the new fluid is introduced.
Okay, so how long do these fluids last in service, Tony, before they...
That's also a complex question, or a simple question with a complex answer. In parts of the system where you have relatively large volumes being used fairly frequently in normal hydraulic valve actuators, then there can be quite a high fluid turnover. If it's a total loss system, then the fluid is eventually discharged. But there are other legs of the system, there are other legs of the system, however, such as subsea completions, subsurface safety valves, and intelligent completions, where the fluid actually is never really discharged. So it's moved backwards and forwards to control components, but doesn't actually get removed from the system.
Okay, so it would stay there pretty much for the life of the device on the sea floor.
That's right, and particularly for in the equipment that actually is in the wellbore itself. And the problem we have there, of course, is that's also an area where it's exposed to some of the most difficult conditions, because that's where you will find some of the extremely high temperatures and also the potential for contamination by liquids or gases in the well stream itself.
Okay, so in terms of the product development programs, you'll have an early stage of concept and proof of concept, which is going to be, I guess, a paper-based exercise at that particular point, looking at the individual chemical components that will give the characteristics you need for your product. You're then going to have basic testing to establish which candidate chemicals to use and which combination won't show any intercompatibility issues. And then you have to look at the characteristics, such as viscosity, density, compressibility, you know, and can they be achieved? Now, and I understand these fit in with the API standards. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think for the first three stages, the sort of concept, proof of concept and so on, we're able to pretty much follow what's stated in API 17N, TRLs 0 and 1 and 2. It's more difficult to follow the subsequent steps, and these are what you really need if you're going to explain to an operator that you have a product that is really ready to be used in anger. And those subsequent steps really are about how you demonstrate the requirements of those TRLs, but in a way that actually is appropriate for something like a control fluid rather than a specific component or assembly. And we've tried to align them with TRLs 3, 4, and 5 by describing the activities undertaken. And it's something which I think has been quite useful to get across these things in terms of a standing that the engineers will be able to follow through. So you've already talked about screening programs to look at, and it's quite a long stage of the process because of the number of candidate formulations and the dictates of both the industry standards and also individual operators. Often you've got to test materials and the many. A routine program would be up to 40 metals and a similar number of non-metallic components. They have to be tested at three different temperatures. Fluid has to be in its pure state and with varying levels of seawater contamination, and you have to measure the affected intervals. So you can easily have around 3,600 tests that would have to be carried out to look at a candidate fluid formulation, and you would hopefully have two or three candidates rather than just the one. And additional testing for individual requirements may add more tests. But that's really analogous to API 17N TRL3. In the next stage, you really have to have access to facilities that allow the candidate formulations to be tested under conditions that accurately reproduce those expected to be seen in service. So TRL4, in essence. And this means you've got to test the fluid in critical system components for extended periods under actual conditions of temperature, pressure, contamination, and also in both static and dynamic conditions, because doing several thousand or tens of thousands of cycles is all fine, but actually what happens if you do one cycle and then leave it for 3 months before anything else happens? Does it move or does it stick? Mm-hmm. And examples would be testing directional control valves, DCVs, or subsurface safety valve actuators, where typically you try and do, particularly on subsurface safety valves, you might well do 3 months of cyclic testing, but you would do that by doing blocks of cycles and then long hold periods to see what actually happened. Now, at the end of that, normally there would be a review of the control fluid with an individual manufacturer's equipment, they would then decide if it met all their stated requirements and it will be qualified for use by each equipment manufacturer. So at that point, the finalized control fluid formulation is fixed. So we now have a design for the actual product. And then I guess the key thing after that is that control system vendors are often responsible for specifying control fluid for a project, but the system may have subsystems that are supplied by others, and operators are also generally a major influencer. So for a control fluid manufacturer, the challenge is to demonstrate to the operator who's considering a new fluid that it will operate satisfactorily across the control system as a whole under the expected field conditions. And the challenge there, I guess, to come to my last point, is API 17 TRL 5 states the newly developed product should be designed and built as a production unit or full-scale prototype and integrated into the intended operating system with a full interface and functional test, but outside the intended field environment. So the designed and built as production unit requirement is straightforward. For a control fluid, it would mean we would manufacture a production batch of product, which would be tested against a predetermined manufacturing specification. The integrated into the intended operating system with full interface and functional test is much more challenging prospect, as regardless of this being done outside of the intended field environment. A full system integration of the entire subsea production control fluid filled with control fluid is unlikely to take place until it's actually installed subsea. So an approach I've used in the past is to undertake a virtual TRL5 analysis. This integrates all the test data that's been generated on the fluid itself and each individual subsea control system element. Then knowing the flow path of the fluid to the system and the expected impact of upset conditions such as contaminants, it's possible to predict what changes might take place in the fluid as it passes through the system and therefore establish whether these changes are likely to have an adverse impact on elements further downstream.
Okay, that's fascinating. And I imagine many of our listeners might be thinking, okay, so how about all these super-duper new all-electric systems? Won't they overcome all and most of these issues?
Yes, all-electric systems is always an interesting question. So I suppose a simple answer would be yes, they would solve a lot of those problems. A more cynical answer might be yes, and that was also the answer back in the late 1990s and in the early noughties. And I think a more pragmatic answer would be yes, but it will take time to become mainstream, and for legacy systems that are trying to keep pace with environmental legislation, retrofitting a new control fluid will be a lot cheaper than replacing the entire production control system.
Okay, and are we still designing total loss control systems, Tony?
So I think the answer is yes, we are at the moment, and it probably prompts a final question from me, which would be, why are we still designing total loss control systems? The world's first electrohydraulic multiplex subsea control system, the first major system, was the Cormorant Underwater Manifold Centre. It was started in mid-1983. Uses closed-loop, non-aqueous hydraulic fluid in its system, and it's still operating successfully 38 years later.
Wow, that's impressive, isn't it? And as we move into this, the sort of the next stage of offshore energy, initially things like the carbon capture and storage side of things, you know, when people are putting things back into the geology, and later on, possibly offshore hydrogen and even maybe offshore geological hydrogen storage. Are these all areas where sort of traditional lubricants will still be able to work, or will a new generation of materials need to be developed?
So subsea carbon capture and storage will in some instances be almost a reverse of the production process. So transportation offshore in carriers or by pipeline requiring remote control. An injection into the storage reservoir under high pressure. Much of the technology may well therefore be similar to that now being introduced for subsea processing, such as subsea boosting and gas compression. These technologies have already required the development of specialist lubricants, which either in their existing form or with appropriate modifications could well be incorporated into carbon capture equipment. There's certainly a requirement for tribology, But of course, it may be possible to use non-liquid lubrication coatings, and of course, magnetic bearings, which I referred to right back at the beginning, have become quite popular. But I think that basic lubricants and lubrication will still be required in many instances. Probably in lower quantities and probably not to be discharged into the marine environment.
Excellent. Okay, thanks for that. Now, you retired from sort of full-time work fairly recently, I think, Tony, didn't you? But I guess you're still very active now as a consultant and into that sort of new phase of your career.
I'm very busy. I hesitate at consultant because I'm not actually doing any paid consultation, but I am, where possible, trying to put together training material and so on to help people in the industry, and particularly where some of the long-term experience has been lost. So I'm always open to questions.
Excellent.
I'm also at the moment in part tied up with some interesting activities, such as setting up, I've just set up video conferencing for the residents in the new apartment block that I've moved into when we retired, so that they can get to see each other during the COVID-19 episode. And that's actually been quite interesting, although I never set out to be an IT specialist.
brilliant. And I should add to our listeners too that you know Tony is somebody who clearly strongly believes in giving something back to the industry, you know, that he spent his career, and he was indeed the very first person to sign up to the SUT patron system, which came out a few months ago, for which I, you know, I've thanked Tony, you know, in the past already. And do you just want to say a couple of words, Tony, about what SUT has done for you over the years? You know, in case we have any listeners who haven't joined yet and are wondering why they should join our society.
I think that SUT for me has always been a forum for good open discussion around what's going on in the subsea industry, for people to get together in, I guess I'd say, non-adversarial environments. You know, there are a lot of conferences, a lot of meetings, a lot of good networking opportunities where people can just sit down and get to learn more about what is actually going on in the industry. And I said earlier on in the presentation that there are there's a need to have a good understanding of many aspects of things, however much you may be specialised in a particular area, because everything interacts, everything is related, and SUT I think is an excellent place to actually gain some of that knowledge, and also a place for people who've got some experience to pass that on to some of the younger members coming in.
Thank you, Tony. That's been really interesting. And now I know a little bit more about the world of tribology. Join us soon for our next episode. Please remember to subscribe, rate and review us, and contact me, steve.hall@sut.org, if you'd like to be featured in a future podcast. Find out more about us at www.sut.org. Thank you to Emily Boddy for composing the theme music and creating the podcast artwork. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back soon with another expert from our broad and fascinating membership. Bye.